Oh, who was in her house? Tessa stumbled for the door, her breath coming short, her heart fluttering in her chest, and made for the main room of the house. For a moment she saw nothing. Her eyes were roomy, filmed over. Shapes looked blurred and distant. Then something rose from beside the fire, and Tessa bit back a scream. It was an automaton. This one was built to look nearly human. It had a thick body, clothed in a dark grey suit, but the arms that protruded from beyond the cuffs were stick-thin, ending in spatulate hands, and the head that rose above the collar was smooth and egg-like. Two bulbous eyes were set into the head, but the machine had no other features.
"Who are you?"
Tessa demanded in the old woman's voice, brandishing the sharp pick she had taken earlier.
"What are you doing in my house, creature?"
The thing made a whirring, clicking noise, obviously confused. A moment later, the front door opened, and Mrs. Black swept in. She was wrapped in her dark cloak, her white face blazing under the hood.
"What's going on here?" she demanded. "Did you find..."
She broke off, staring at Tessa.
"What's going on?"
Tessa demanded, her voice coming out in the old woman's high whine.
"I ought to ask you that, breaking into perfectly decent folks' homes."
She blinked, as if to make it clear she couldn't see very well.
"Get out of here, and take your friend."
She jabbed the object she held.
"A frog pick," said the voice of the old woman in her mind. "You use it for cleaning horses' hooves, silly girl. With you. You'll find nothing here worth stealing."
For a moment she thought it had worked. Mrs. Black's face was expressionless. She took a step forward.
"You haven't seen a young girl in these parts, have you?"
she asked.
"Very finely dressed, brown hair, grey eyes. She would have looked lost. Her people are looking for her, and offering a handsome reward."
"A likely story. Looking for some lost girl."
Tessa sounded as surly as she could. It wasn't difficult. She had a feeling the old woman, whose face she was wearing, had been a naturally surly sort.
"Get out, I said!"
The automaton whirred. Mrs. Black's lips pressed suddenly together, as if they were holding back laughter.
"I see," she said. "Might I say that's quite a fine necklace you're wearing, old woman?"
Tessa's hand flew to her chest, but it was already too late. The clockwork angel was there, clearly visible, ticking gently.
"Take her,"
said Mrs. Black in a bored voice, and the automaton lurched forward, reaching for Tessa. She dropped the blanket and backed away, brandishing her frog pick. She managed to rake quite a long gash down the automaton's front as it reached for her and knocked her arm aside. The frog pick clattered to the floor, and Tessa cried out in pain, just as the front door opened and a flood of automatons filled the room, their arms reaching for her, their mechanical hands closing on her flesh. Knowing she was overpowered, knowing it would not do a bit of good, she finally allowed herself to scream. Sun on his face woke Will. He blinked, opening his eyes slowly. Blue sky. He rolled over and stretched stiffly into a sitting position. He was on the rise of a green hill, just out of sight of the Shrewsbury to Welshpool road. He could see nothing all around him but scattered farmhouses in the distance. He had passed only a few tiny hamlets on his frantic midnight ride away from the Green Man, riding until he literally slid from Balios's back in exhaustion and hit the dirt with bone-jarring force. Half walking and half crawling, he had let his exhausted horse nose him off the road and into a slight dip in the ground, where he had curled up and fallen asleep, heedless of the drizzle of cold rain that had still been falling. Sometime between then and now the sun had come up, drying his clothes and hair, though he was still dirty, his shirt a mess of caked mud and blood. He rose to his feet, his whole body aching. He hadn't bothered with any kind of healing wounds the previous night. He'd gone into the inn, tracking rain and mud behind him, only to retrieve his things, before returning to the stables to free Balios and hurtle off into the night. The injuries he'd sustained in his battle against Wolsey's pack still hurt, as did the bruises from falling off the horse. He limped stiffly to where Balios was cropping grass near the shade of a spreading oak tree. A rummage through the saddlebags yielded a steely and a handful of dried fruit. He used the one to trace himself with pain-killing and healing runes in between taking bites of the other. The events of the night before seemed 1,000 miles away. He remembered fighting the wolves, the splinter of bones and the taste of his own blood, the mud and the rain. He remembered the pain of the severance from Jem, though he could no longer feel it. Instead of pain, he felt hollowness, as if some great hand had reached down and cut everything that made him human out of his insides, leaving him a shell. When he was done with breakfast, he returned to his steely to his saddlebag, stripped off his ruined shirt, and changed into a clean one. As he did so, he could not help but glance down at the Parabatai rune on his chest. It was not black, but silver-white, like a long-faded scar. Will could hear Jem's voice in his head, steady and serious and familiar. And it came to pass that the soul of Jonathan was knit with the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as his own soul. Then Jonathan and David made a covenant because he loved him as his own soul. They were two warriors, and their souls were knit together by heaven. And out of that, Jonathan Shadowhunter took the idea of Parabatai and encoded the ceremony into the law. For years now, this mark and Jem's presence had been all Will had had in his life to assure him that he was loved by anybody. All that he'd had to know that he was real and existed. He traced his fingers over the edges of the faded Parabatai rune. He thought he would hate it, hate the sight of it in sunlight, but he found to his surprise that he didn't. He was glad the Parabatai rune had not simply vanished off his skin. A mark that spoke of loss was still a mark, a remembrance. You could not lose something you had never had. Out of the saddlebag he took the knife Jem had given him, a narrow blade with the intricate silver handle. In the shadow of the oak tree, he cut the palm of his hand and watched as the blood ran into the ground, soaking the earth. Then he knelt and plunged the blade into the bloody ground. Kneeling, he hesitated, one hand on the hilt. "James Carstairs," he said, and swallowed. It was always this way. When he needed words the most, he could not find them. The words of the biblical Parabatai oath came into his head. "Entreat me not to leave thee, or to return from following after thee. For whither thou goest, I will go, and where thou lodgest, I will lodge. Thy people should be my people, and thy God my God. Where thou diest, will I die, and there will I be buried. The angel do so to me, and more also, if aught but death part thee and me." But no, that was what was said when you were joined, not when you were cut apart. David and Jonathan had been separated too by death. Separated, but not divided. "I told you before, Jem, that you would not leave me," Will said, his bloody hand on the hilt of the dagger. "And you are still with me. When I breathe, I will think of you, for without you, I would have been dead years ago. When I wake up and when I sleep, when I lift my hands to defend myself or when I lie down to die, you will be with me. You say we are born and born again. I say there is a river that divides the dead and the living. What I do know is that if we are born again, I will meet you in another life, and if there is a river, you will wait on the shores for me to come to you, so that we can cross together." Will took a deep breath and then let go of the knife. He drew his hand back. The cut on his palm was already healing, the result of 6 irazes on his skin. "You hear that, James Carstairs? We are bound, you and I, over the divide of death, down through whatever generations may come, forever." He rose to his feet and looked down at the knife. The knife was Jem's, the blood was his. This spot of ground, whether he could ever find it again, whether he lived to try, would be theirs. He turned to walk toward Balios, toward Wales and Tessa. He did not look back.
2. Charlotte Branwell, from Consul Desire Wayland, by footman. "My dear Mrs. Branwell, I am not certain that I perfectly understood your missive. It seems incredible to me that a sensible woman such as yourself should place such reliance on the bare word of a boy as notoriously reckless and unreliable as William Herondale has time and time again proved himself to be. I certainly will not do so. Mr. Herondale has, as shown by his own letter, raced away on a wild chase without your knowledge. He is absolutely capable of fabrication in order to aid his cause. I will not send a large force of my shadow hunters on the whim and careless word of a boy. Pray cease your peremptory rally cries to Kader Idris. Attempt to keep in mind that I am the consul. I command the armies of the shadow hunters, madam, not yourself. Fix your mind instead on an attempt to better keep your shadow hunters in check. Yours truly, Josiah Wayland, consul.
There's a man here to see you, Mrs. Bramwell.
Charlotte glanced up wearily to see Sophie standing in the doorway. She looked tired, as they all did. The unmistakable traces of weeping were beneath her eyes. Charlotte knew the signs. She had seen them in her own mirror that morning. She sat behind the desk in the drawing room, staring down at the letter in her hand. She had not expected Consul Wayland to be pleased by her news, but neither had she expected this blank contempt and refusal.
I command the armies of the Shadow Hunters, madam, not yourself. Fix your mind instead on an attempt to better keep your Shadow Hunters in check.
Keep them in check, she fumed, as if they were all children and she no better than their governess or nursemaid, parading them in front of the consul when they were washed and dressed, and hiding them in the playroom the rest of the time, that he not be disturbed. They were shadow hunters, and so was she, and if he did not think that Will was reliable, he was a fool. He knew of the curse. She had told him herself. Will's madness had always been like Hamlet's, half play and half wildness, and all driving toward a certain end. The fire crackled in the grate. Outside, the rain sheeted down, painting the window panes in silver lines. That morning she had passed Jem's bedroom, the door open, the bed divested of its linens, the possessions cleared away. It could have been anyone's room. All the evidence of his years with them gone with a wave of a hand. She had leaned against the wall of the corridor, sweat beading on her brow, her eyes burning. Raziel, did I do the right thing? She passed her hand over her eyes now. Now of all times. It isn't Consul Wayland, is it?
No, ma'am. Sophie shook her dark head. It's Aloysius Starkweather. He says it's a matter of the greatest urgency.
Aloysius Starkweather? Charlotte sighed. Some days simply piled horror on horror. Well, let him in then.
She folded the letter she had written as a response to the consul, and had just sealed it when Sophie returned and ushered Aloysius Starkweather into the room before excusing herself. Charlotte did not rise from her desk. Starkweather looked much as he had the last time she had seen him. He seemed to have calcified, as if while he was getting no younger, he could get no older either. His face was a map of wrinkled lines, framed with a white beard and white hair. His clothes were dry. Sophie must have hung his overcoat downstairs. The suit he wore was at least 10 years out of fashion, and he smelled faintly of old mothballs.
"Please be seated, Mr. Starkweather," said Charlotte as courteously as she could to someone who she knew disliked her and had hated her father. But he did not sit down. His hands were locked behind his back, and as he turned, surveying the room around him, Charlotte saw with a flash of alarm that one of the cuffs of his jacket was splattered with blood.
"Mr. Starkweather," she said. And now she did rise. "Are you hurt? Should I summon the brothers?"
"Hurt?"
he barked out.
"Why would I be hurt?"
"Your sleeve," she pointed.
He drew his arm away and gazed at it before huffing out a laugh.
"Not my blood," he said. "I was in a fight earlier. He took objection."
"Took objection to what?"
"To my cutting off all his fingers and then slitting his throat," said Starkweather, meeting her eyes.
His own were grey-black, the colour of stone.
"Aloysius," Charlotte forgot to be polite, "the Accords forbid unprovoked attacks on downworlders."
"Unprovoked? I'd say this was provoked. His folk murdered my granddaughter. My daughter nearly died of grief. The House of Starkweather destroyed."
"Aloysius," Charlotte was seriously alarmed now, "your house is not destroyed. There are still Starkweathers in Idris. I do not say that to minimize your sorrow,
for some losses are always with us.
Jem, she thought, unbidden, and the pain of the thought pushed her back into the chair. She rested her elbows on the table, her face in her hands.
I do not know why you came to tell me this now, she murmured. Did you not see the runes upon the door of the Institute? This is a time of great sorrow for us.
I came to tell you because it's important. Aloysius flared up. It regards Mortmain and Tessa Grey.
Charlotte lowered her hands.
What do you know of Tessa Grey?
Aloysius had turned away. He stood facing the fire, his long shadow cast across the Persian rug on the floor.
I'm not a man who thinks much of the Accords, he said. You know it. You have been in councils with me. I was brought up to believe that everything touched by demons was foul and corrupt, that it was the blood right of a shadow hunter to kill these creatures, and to take what they had as spoils and treasure. The spoils room of the Institute in York was left in my charge, and I kept it filled until the day the new laws were passed.
He scowled. Let me guess, said Charlotte. You did not stop there.
Of course not, said the old man. What are man's laws to the angels? I know the right way of doing things. I kept a lower profile, but I did not cease taking spoils or destroying those downworlders who crossed my path. One of those was John Shade.
Mortmain's father.
Warlocks cannot have children, snarled Starkweather. Some human boy they found and trained up. Shade taught him his unholy tinkering ways, won his trust.
It's unlikely the Shade stole Mortmain from his parents, said Charlotte. He was probably a boy who would have died in a workhouse otherwise.
It was unnatural. Warlocks should not have human children to raise.
Aloysius stared deep within the red embers of the fire.
That is why we raided Shade's house. We killed him and his wife. The boy escaped. Shade's clockwork prince. He snorted. We took several of his items back with us to the Institute, but none of us could make head nor tail of them. That was all there was to it. A routine raid. Everything according to plan. That is, until my granddaughter was born, Adele.
I know that she died at her first rune ceremony, said Charlotte, her hand unconsciously going to her own belly. I am sorry. It is a great sorrow to have a sickly child.
She was not born sickly, he barked. She was a healthy infant, beautiful, with my son's eyes. Everyone doted on her, until one morning my daughter-in-law woke us with a scream. She insisted that the child in her cradle was not her daughter, that they looked exactly alike. She swore she knew her own child, and this was not it. We thought she had gone mad, even when the baby's eyes changed from blue to grey. Well, that happens often with infants. It wasn't until we tried to apply her first marks that I began to realize my daughter-in-law had been right. Adele, the pain was excruciating for her. She screamed and screamed and writhed. Her skin burned where the steely touched her. The Silent Brothers did all they could, but by the next morning, she was dead.
Aloysius paused and was silent for a long time, gazing, as if fascinated, into the fire.
My daughter-in-law nearly went mad. She could not bear to remain in the Institute. I stayed. I knew she had been correct. Adele was not my granddaughter. I heard rumours of fairies and other downworlders who boasted that they had taken their revenge on the Starkweathers, had taken one of their children from them, and replaced her with a sickly human. None of my investigations yielded anything concrete, but I was determined to find out where my granddaughter had gone. He leaned on the mantel. I'd nearly given up when Tessa Grey came to my Institute in the company of your two shadow hunters. She could have been the ghost of my daughter-in-law. So similar did they look. But she did not appear to have any shadow hunter blood. It was a mystery, but one I pursued. The fairy I interrogated today gave me the last bits of the puzzle. In her infancy, my granddaughter was replaced with a kidnapped human child, a sickly creature who died when the marks were applied because she was not Nephilim.
There was a hard crack in his voice now, a fissure in the flint.
My granddaughter was left with a mundane family to raise her, their sickly Elizabeth, chosen because of her superficial resemblance to Adele, replaced with our healthy girl. That was the court's revenge on me. They believed I had killed their own, so they would kill mine.
His eyes were cold as they rested on Charlotte.
Adele, Elizabeth, grew to womanhood in that mundane family, never knowing what she was. And then she married a mundane man. His name was Richard. Richard Grey.
Your granddaughter, Charlotte said slowly, was Tess's mother, Elizabeth Grey. Tess's mother was a shadow hunter.
Yes.
These are crimes, Aloysius. You should go to the council with this.
They do not care about Tessa Grey, said Starkweather roughly. But you do. You will listen to my story because of it, and you may help me because of it.
I may, said Charlotte, if it is the right thing to do. I do not yet understand how Mortmain comes into this story. Aloysius moved restlessly.
Mortmain learned of what happened, and determined that he would make use of Elizabeth Grey, a shadow hunter, who did not know that she was a shadow hunter. I believe that Mortmain courted Richard Grey as an employee in order to grant himself access to Elizabeth. I believe he loosed an idling demon upon her, my granddaughter, in the shape of her husband, and that he did it in order to get Tessa on her. Tessa was always the goal. The child of a shadow hunter and a demon.
But the offspring of demons and shadow hunters are stillborn, Charlotte said automatically.
Even if the shadow hunter does not know that they are a shadow hunter, said Starkweather. Even if they carry no runes.
Charlotte closed her mouth. She had no idea what the answer was. As far as she knew, the situation had never occurred. Shadow hunters were marked when children, male and female, all of them. But Elizabeth Grey had not been.
I know the girl is a shapeshifter, said Starkweather. But I do not believe that is why he wants her. There is something else he wants her to do. Something only she can do. She is the key.
The key to what?
It was the last words the fairy spoke to me this afternoon. Starkweather glanced at the blood on his sleeve. He said, she is to be our vengeance for all your wasteful death. She will bring ruin to the Nephilim, and London will burn. And when the Magister rules over all, you'll be no more to him than cattle in a pen. Even if the consul does not wish to go after Tessa for her own sake, they ought to go after her to prevent that.
If they believe it, said Charlotte.
Coming from your lips, they must, said Starkweather. If it came from me, they would laugh me off as a mad old man, as they've done for years.
Oh, Aloysius, you far overestimate the trust the consul has in me. He will say I am a foolish, credulous woman. He will say the fairy lied to you. Well, they cannot lie, but twisted the truth, or repeated the truth as he believed it. The old man looked away, his mouth working.
Tessa Grey is the key to Mortmain's plan, he said. I do not know how, but she is. I've come to you because I do not trust the council with Tessa. She's part demon. I remember what in the past I've done to things that were part demon or supernatural.
Tessa is not a thing, Charlotte said. She is a girl, and she has been kidnapped and is probably terrified. Don't you think if I could have thought of a way to save her already, I would have done it?
I have done wrong, said Aloysius. I want to make this right. My blood runs in that girl's veins, even if demon blood does as well. She is my great-granddaughter.
He raised his chin, his watery pale eyes rimmed with red.
I ask only one thing of you, Charlotte. When you find Tessa Grey, and you will find her, tell her she is welcome to the name of Starkweather.
Do not make me regret that I have trusted you, Gabriel Lightwood.
Gabriel sat at the desk in his room, writing papers spread out before him, pen in hand. The lamps in the room were not lit, and the shadows were dark in the corners and long across the floors. 2. Consul Josiah Wayland. From Gabriel Lightwood. Most honored consul, I write to you today at last with the news that you requested of me.
I had expected it to come from Idris, but as chance would have it, its source is much closer to home. Today, Aloysius Starkweather, head of the York Institute, came to call upon Mrs. Branwell. He set the pen down and took a deep breath. He had heard the bell of the Institute ring earlier, had watched from the stairs as Sophie had ushered Starkweather into the house and up to the drawing room. It was easy enough after that to station himself at the door and listen to everything that passed within the room. Charlotte did not, after all, expect to be spied on. He is an old man gone mad with grief, and as such has created an elaborate set of fabrications with which he explains to himself his great loss. He is certainly to be pitied, but not to be taken seriously, nor should the policy of the council rest upon the words of the untrustworthy and the mad. The floorboards creaked. Gabriel's head jerked up. His heart was pounding. If it was Gideon, Gideon would be horrified to discover what he was doing. They all would. He thought of the look of betrayal that would bloom across Charlotte's small face if she knew. Henry's bewildered anger. Most of all, he thought of the pair of blue eyes and the heart-shaped face, looking at him with disappointment.
Maybe I have faith in you, Gabriel Lightwood.
When he set the pen back to the letter, he did so with such ferocity that the pen nearly tore through the paper.
I regret to report this, but they spoke together of both counsel and consul with great disrespect. It is clear that Mrs. Branwell resents what she sees as unnecessary interference in her plans. She met Mr. Starkweather's wild claims, such as that Mortmain has bred demons and shadow hunters together, a clear impossibility, with sheer credulousness. It appears that you are correct, and that she is far too headstrong and easily influenced to head an institute properly.
Gabriel bit his lip and forced himself not to think of Cecily. Instead he thought of Lightwood House, his birthright, the good name of the Lightwoods restored, the safety of his brother and sister. He was not really harming Charlotte. It was only a question of her position, not her safety. The consul had no dark plans for her. Surely she would be happier in Idris, or in some country house, watching her children run over green lawns and not worrying constantly about the fate of all shadow hunters.
Though Mrs. Branwell exhorts you to send a force of shadow hunters to Cadder Idris, anyone who makes the opinions of madmen and hysterics the cornerstone of their policies lacks the objectivity to be trusted. If necessary, I shall swear by the mortal sword that all this is true. Yours, in Raziel's name, Gabriel Lightwood.
Chapter 16. The Clockwork Princess. O love, who bewailest the frailty of all things here, why choose you the frailest for your cradle, your home, and your bier? Percy Bysshe Shelley, lines, When the Lamp is Shattered. 2. Consul to Sir Wayland, from Charlotte Branwell. Dear Consul Wayland, I have but this moment received tidings of the gravest import, which I hasten to impart to you. An informant, whose name I cannot at this time disclose, but whom I vouch for as reliable, has relayed to me details that suggest to me that Miss Grey is no mere passing fancy of Mortmain's, but a key to his main objective, to wit, the utter destruction of us all. He plots to construct devices of greater power than any we have yet before seen, and I deeply fear that Miss Grey's unique abilities will aid him in this endeavour. She would never intend to harm us, but we do not know what threats or indignities Mortmain will offer her. It is imperative that she be rescued at once, as much to save us all as to aid her. In light of this new information, I once more implore you to gather what forces you may and march upon Cadder Idris. Yours sincerely, and in sincere distress, Charlotte Branwell.
Tessa woke slowly, as if consciousness were at the end of a long, dark corridor, and she were walking toward it at a snail's pace, her hand outstretched. Finally she reached it, and swung the door open to reveal. Blinding light. It was golden light, not pale like witch light. She sat up and looked around her. She was in a simple brass bed, with a deep feather tick spread over a second mattress, and a heavy eiderdown quilt on top. The room she was in looked as if it had been hollowed out of a cave. There was a tall dresser and a washstand with a blue jug on it. And there was also a wardrobe, its door hanging open just enough that Dessa could see the garments hung inside. There were no windows in the room, though there was a fireplace in which a cheerful blaze burned. On either side of the fireplace were hung portraits. She slid from the bed and winced as her bare feet encountered cold stone. It was not as painful as she would have expected, though, given her battered state. Glancing down, she had two quick shocks. The first was that she was wearing nothing but an oversized black silk dressing gown. The second was that her cuts and bruises seemed to have largely disappeared. She still felt slightly sore, but her skin, pale against the black silk, was unmarked. Touching her hair, she felt that it was clean and loose around her shoulders, no longer matted with mud and blood. That did leave the question of who had cleaned her, healed her, and put her in this bed. Tessa remembered nothing beyond struggling with the automatons in the small farmhouse, while Mrs. Black laughed. Eventually, one of them had choked her into unconsciousness, and a merciful darkness had come. Still, the idea of Mrs. Black undressing and bathing her was horrible, though not perhaps as horrible as the idea of Mortmain doing it. Most of the furniture in the room was grouped on one side of the cave. The other side was largely bare, though she could see the black rectangle of a doorway cut into the far wall. After a brief glance around, she made her way toward it, only to find herself halfway across the room, brought up bruisingly short. She staggered back, gathering her dressing gown more tightly about her, her forehead stinging where she had smacked it on something. Gingerly, she reached out, tracing the air in front of her. And she felt solid hardness in front of her, as if a perfectly clear glass wall stood between her and the other side of the room. She flattened her hands against it. Invisible it might be, but it was as hard as adamant. She moved her hands up, wondering how high it could possibly go. "I wouldn't bother," said a cold, familiar voice from the door. "The configuration stretches all the way across the cave, from wall to wall, from roof to ceiling. You are completely immune behind it." Tessa had been stretching upward. At that, she dropped to her feet and backed up a step. Mortmain. He was exactly as she recalled him. A wiry man, not tall, with a weathered face and a neatly clipped beard. Extraordinarily ordinary, save for his eyes, as cold and grey as a winter snowstorm. He wore a dove-coloured suit, not overly formal, the sort of thing a gentleman might wear to an afternoon at the club. His shoes were polished to a high shine. Tessa said nothing, only drew the black dressing gown closer about her. It was voluminous and concealed her whole body, but without the underpinnings of chemise and corset, stockings and bustle, she felt naked and exposed.
"Do not panic yourself," Mortmain went on. "It cannot reach me through the wall, but neither can I reach you. Not without dissolving the spell itself, and that would take time." He paused. "I wish for you to feel safer."
"If you wished me to be safe, you would have left me at the Institute."
Tessa's tone was bone-chillingly cold. Mortmain said nothing to that. Only cocked his head and squinted at her, like a sailor squinting at the horizon.
"My condolences on the death of your brother. I never meant for that to happen."
Tessa felt her mouth twist into a terrible shape. It had been 2 months since Nate had died in her arms, but she had not forgotten or forgiven.
"I don't want your pity or your good wishes. You made him a tool of yours and then he died. It was your fault. As surely as if you had shot him in the street." "I suppose it would avail little to point out that he was the one who sought me out."
"He was just a boy," Tessa said.
She wanted to sink to her knees, wanted to pound against the invisible barrier with her fists, but she held herself upright and cold.
"He was not even 20.
Mortmain slid his hands into his pockets.
"Do you know what it was like for me when I was a boy?" he said, in as calm a tone as if he had been seated beside her at a dinner party and forced to make conversation.
Tessa thought of the images she had seen in Aloysius Starkweather's mind.
"The man was tall, broad-shouldered,
and as green-skinned as a lizard. His hair was black. The child he held by the hand, by contrast, seemed as normal as a child could be. Small, chubby-fisted, pink-skinned. Tessa knew the man's name because Starkweather knew it. John Shade. Shade hoisted the child up onto his shoulders as through the door of the house spilled a number of odd-looking metal creatures, like a child's jointed dolls, but human size, and with skin made of shining metal. The creatures were featureless, though oddly they wore clothes, the rough workman's coveralls of a Yorkshire farmer on some, and on others, plain muslin dresses. The automatons joined hands and began to sway as if they were at a country dance. The child laughed and clapped his hands.
"Look well on this, my son," said the green-skinned man, "for one day I shall rule the clockwork kingdom of such beings, and you shall be its prince."
"I know your adoptive parents were warlocks," she said, "and I know that they cared for you. I know that your father invented the clockwork creatures with which you are so enamored.
And you know what happened to them?"
A room torn apart. Cogs and cams and gears and ripped metal everywhere. Fluid leaking as black as blood, and the green-skinned man and blue-haired woman lying dead among the ruins. Tessa looked away.
"Let me tell you about my childhood," Mortmain said. "Adoptive parents, you call them. But they were as much my parents as any amount of blood could make them. They raised me up with care and love, just as yours did you."
He gestured toward the fireplace, and Tessa realized with a dull shock the portraits that hung on either side were portraits of her own parents, her fair-haired mother and her thoughtful-looking father with his brown eyes and tie askew.
"And then they were killed by shadow hunters. My father wanted to create these beautiful automatons, these clockwork creatures, as you call them. They would be the greatest machines ever invented, he dreamed, and they would protect downworlders against the shadow hunters who routinely murdered and stole from them. You saw the spoils in Starkweather's Institute." He spat the last words. "You saw pieces of my parents. He kept my mother's blood in a jar."
And the remains of warlocks, mummified taloned hands like Mrs. Black's, a stripped skull, utterly defleshed, human-looking, save that it had tusks instead of teeth, vials of sludgy-looking blood. Tessa swallowed.
"My mother's blood in a jar."
She could not say she did not understand his rage, and yet she thought of Jem, his parents dying in front of him, his own life destroyed, and yet he had never sought revenge.
"Yes, that was horrible," Tessa said, "but it does not excuse the things you've done."
A flicker of something deep in his eyes, rage, quickly tamped down.
"Let me tell you what I've done," he said. "I've created an army. An army that, once the final piece of the puzzle is in place, will be invincible."
"And the final piece of the puzzle?"
"Is you," said Mortmain.
"You say that over and over, and yet you refuse to explain it," Tessa said. "You demand my cooperation, and yet you tell me nothing.
You have me imprisoned here, sir, but you cannot force my speech with you, or my willingness if I choose not to give it."
"You are half shadow hunter, half demon," Mortmain said. "That is the first thing you should know."
Tessa, already half turned away from him, froze.
"That is not possible. The offspring of shadow hunters and demons are stillborn."
"Yes, they are," he said. "They are. The blood of a shadow hunter, the runes on the body of a shadow hunter, are death to a warlock child in the womb. But your mother was not marked."
"My mother was not a shadow hunter."
Tessa looked wildly to the portrait of Elizabeth Grey over the fireplace.
"Or are you saying she lied to my father? Lied to everyone, all her life?"
"She did not know," said Mortmain. "The shadow hunters did not know it. There was no one to tell her. My father built your clockwork angel, you know. It was meant to be a gift for my mother. It contains within it a bit of the spirit of an angel, a rare thing, something he had carried with him since the Crusades. The mechanism itself was meant to be tuned to her life, so that every time her life was threatened, the angel would intervene to protect her. However, my father never had a chance to finish it. He was murdered first. Mortmain began to pace. My parents were not singled out for murder, of course. Starkweather and his kind delighted in slaughtering downwelders. They grew rich off the spoils, and would take the slightest excuse to bring violence against them. For that, he was hated by the downwelder community. It was the fairies of the countryside who helped me escape when my parents were killed, and who hid me until the shadow hunters stopped looking for me. He took a shuddering breath. Years later, when they decided to have their revenge, I helped them. Institutes are protected against the ingress of downworlders, but not against mundanes, and not, of course, against automatons. He smiled a terrible smile. It was I, with the help of one of my father's inventions, who crept into the York Institute and switched the baby in the crib there for one of mundane descent. Starkweather's granddaughter, Adele.
Adele, Tessa whispered. I saw a portrait of her. A very young girl with long fair hair, dressed in an old-fashioned child's dress, a great ribbon surmounting her small head. Her face was thin and pale and sickly, but her eyes were bright.
She died when the first runes were put on her, said Mortmain with relish. Died screaming, as so many downworlders had before at the hands of shadow hunters. Now they had killed one they had come to love. A fitting retribution.
Tessa stared at him in horror. How could anyone think that to die in agony was fitting retribution for an innocent child? She thought of Jem again, his hands gentle on his violin.
Elizabeth, your mother, grew up not knowing that she was a shadow hunter. No runes were given to her. I followed her progress, of course, and when she married Richard Grey, I made sure I employed him. I believe that the lack of runes on your mother meant that she could conceive a child who was half demon, half shadow hunter, and to test that theory, I sent a demon to her in the shape of your father. She never knew the difference.
Only the emptiness in Tessa's stomach kept her from being sick.
You did what? To my mother? A demon? I am half demon?
He was a greater demon, if that comforts you. Most of them were angels once. He was fair enough, in his own aspect, Mortmain smirked. Before your mother became pregnant, I had worked for years to finish my father's clockwork angel. I finished it, and after you were conceived, tuned it to your life. My greatest invention.
Why would my mother be willing to wear it?
To save you, said Mortmain. Your mother realized that something was wrong when she became pregnant. To carry a warlock child is not like carrying a human child. I came to her then, and gave her the clockwork angel. I told her that wearing it would save her child's life. She believed me. I was not lying. You are immortal, girl, but you are not invulnerable. You can be killed. The angel is tuned to your life. It is designed to save you if you are dying. It may have saved you 100 times before you were ever born, and it saved you since. Think of the times you've been close to death. Think of the way it intervened.
Tessa thought back. The way her angel had flown at the automaton choking her, had fended off the blades of the creature that attacked her near Ravenscore Manor, had kept her from being dashed to pieces on the rocks of the ravine. But it did not save me from torture nor injury.
No. For those are part of the human condition.
So is death, said Tessa. I am not human, and you let the Dark Sisters torture me. I could never forgive you for that. Even if you convinced me my brother's death was his fault, that Thomas's death was justified, that your hatred was reasonable, I could never forgive you for that.
Mortmain lifted the box at his feet and upended it.
There was a rattling crash as cogs fell from it. Cogs and cams and gears, sheared off bits of metal smeared with black fluid, and lastly, bouncing atop the rest of the rubbish like a child's red rubber ball, a severed head. Mrs. Black's.
"I destroyed her," he said. "For you. I wish to show you I am sincere, Miss Grey."
"Sincere in what?" Tessa demanded. "Why did you do all this? Why did you create me?" His lips twitched slightly. It was not a smile, not really.
"For two purposes. The first is so that you can bear children."
"But warlocks cannot..."
"No," said Mortmain, "but you are no ordinary warlock. In you the blood of demons and the blood of angels has fought its own war in heaven, and the angels have been victorious. You are not a shadow hunter, but you are not a warlock either. You are something new, something entirely other."
"Shadow hunters," he spat.
"All shadow hunter and demon hybrids die, and the Nephilim are proud of it, glad that their blood will never be filthied, their lineage tainted by magic. But you, you can do magic. You can have children like any other woman. Not for some years yet, but when you reach your full maturity. The greatest warlocks alive have assured me of it. Together, we will start a new race, with the Shadow Hunter's beauty, and with no warlock mark. It will be a race that will break the Shadow Hunter's arrogance by replacing them on this earth."
Tessa's legs gave out. She slumped on the floor, her dressing gown pooling around her like black water.
You want to use me to breed your children?"
Now he did grin.
"I am not a man without honor," he said. "I offer you marriage. I always planned that." He gestured at the pitiful pile of ragged metal and flesh that had been Mrs. Black. "If I can have your willing participation, I would prefer it. And I can promise I shall deal thus with all your enemies."
My enemies? She thought of Nate, his hand closing on hers as he died, bloody in her lap. She thought of Jem again, the way he never railed against his fate but faced it down bravely. She thought of Charlotte, who wept over Jessamine's death, though Jesse had betrayed her. And she thought of Will, who had laid down his heart for her and Jem to walk upon, because he loved them more than he loved himself. There was human goodness in the world, she thought, all caught up with desires and dreams, regrets and bitterness, resentments and powers, but it was there, and Mortmain would never see it. "You will never understand," she said. "You say that you build, that you invent, but I know an inventor, Henry Bramwell, and you are nothing like him. He brings things to life, you just destroy. And now you bring me another dead demon, as if it were flowers rather than more death? You have no feelings, Mr. Mortmain, no empathy for anyone. If I had not known it before, it would have been made abundantly clear when you tried to use James Carstairs' illness to force me to come here. Though he is dying because of you, he wouldn't allow me to come, wouldn't take your Yin Fen. That's how good people behave."
She saw the look on his face. Disappointment. It was only there for a moment, though, before it was wiped away with a shrewd look.
"Wouldn't allow you to come," he said. "So I did not misjudge you. You would have done it. Would have come to me, here, out of love."
"Not love for you."
"No," he said thoughtfully. "Not for me."
And he drew from his pocket an object that Tessa recognized immediately. She stared at the watch he held out at her, dangling on its gold chain. It was clearly unwound. The hands had long ago stopped spinning, the time seemingly frozen at midnight. The initials, J.T.S., were carved on the back in elegant script.
"I said there were two reasons I created you," he said. "This is the second. There are shapeshifters in the world, demons and magicians, who can take on appearances of others. But only you can truly become someone else. This watch was my father's, John Thaddeus Shade. I beg of you to take this watch and change into my father, so I may speak with him one more time. If you do that, I will send all the Yin Fen I have in my possession, and there is a considerable amount, to James Carstairs.
He will not take it, Tessa said immediately.
Why not?
His tone was reasonable. You are no longer a condition of the drug. It is a gift, freely given. It would be foolish to throw it away and avail nothing. Whereas by doing this small thing for me, you may well save his life.
What do you say to that, Tessa Gray?
Will. Will, wake up.
It was Tessa's voice, unmistakably, and it brought Will bolt upright in the saddle. He caught at Balios's mane to steady himself and looked around blearily. Green, grey, blue. The vista of Welsh countryside spread out before him. He had passed Welshpool and the England-Wales border some time around dawn. He remembered little of his journey, only a continuous, torturous progression of places. Norton, Outcham, Emstrey, Weeping Cross, diverting himself and his horse around Shrewsbury, and finally the border, and Welsh hills in the distance. They had been ghostly in the morning light, everything shrouded in mist that had burnt off slowly as the sun had risen overhead. He guessed he was somewhere near Langadath. It was a pretty road, laid over an old Roman byway, but almost empty of habitation apart from the occasional farm, and it seemed endlessly long, longer than the grey sky stretching overhead. At the Cairn Office Hotel, he had forced himself to stop and take some food, but only for moments. The journey was what mattered. Now that he was in Wales, he could feel it. The draw in his blood toward the place where he had been born. Despite all Cecily's words, he had not felt the connection in him until now. Breathing Welsh air, seeing the Welsh colours, the green of hills, grey of slate and sky, the pallor of whitewashed stone houses, the ivory dots of sheep against the grass. Pine and oak trees were dark emerald in the distance. Higher up, but closer to the road, the vegetation grew green-grey and ochre. As he moved farther into the heart of the country, the soft green rolling hills grew starker, the road steeper, and the sun began to sink toward the rim of the distant mountains. He knew where he was now, knew when he passed into Davy Valley, and the mountains in front of him thrust up, stark and ragged. The peak of Caerphron was on his left, a tumble of grey slate and shingle-like broken grey spiderweb across its side. The road was steep and long, and as Will urged Balios up it, he slumped in the saddle and, against his will, drifted out of consciousness. He dreamed of Cecily and Ella, running up and down hills not unlike these, calling after him.
Will! Come and run with us, Will!
And he dreamed of Tessa, and her hands held out for him, and he knew he could not stop until he reached her. Even if she never looked at him like that in waking life, even if that softness in her eyes was for someone else. And sometimes, as now, his hand would slip into his pocket and close around the jade pendant there. Something struck him hard from the side. He released the pendant as he fell jarringly onto the rocky grass by the side of the road. Pain shot up his arm, and he rolled to the side just in time to avoid Balios crumpling to the earth beside him. It took him a moment, gasping, to realize that they had not been attacked. His horse, too exhausted to take another step, had collapsed beneath him. Will heaved himself up to his knees and crawled to Balios's side. The black horse lay lathered in foam, his eyes rolling upward pitifully toward Will as Will neared him and flung an arm around his neck. To his relief, the horse's pulse was steady and strong.
Palios! Palios!
He whispered, stroking the animal's mane.
I am sorry. I should not have ridden you like that.
He remembered when Henry had bought the horses and was trying to decide what to name them. Will had been the one to suggest their names, Balios and Xanthos, after the immortal horses of Achilles.
We too can fly as swiftly as Zephyrus, who they say is the fleetest of all winds.
But those horses had been immortal, and Balios was not. Stronger than an ordinary horse and faster, but every creature had its limits. Will lay down, his head spinning, and stared up at the sky. Like a grey sheet pulled tight,
touched here and there with streaks of black cloud. He had thought once, in the brief moments between the lifting of the curse and the knowledge that Jem and Tessa were engaged, of bringing Tessa here to Wales, to show her the places he had been as a child. He thought to take her down to Pembrokeshire, to walk around St. David's Head, and see the clifftop flowers there, to see the blue sea from Tenby, and find seashells at the tide lines. These all seemed the distant fancies of a child now. There was only the road ahead, more riding and more exhaustion, and probably death at the end of it. With another reassuring pat on his horse's neck, Will heaved himself to his knees and then his feet. Fighting dizziness, he limped to the crest of the hill and looked down. A small valley lay below him, and within it was cradled a diminutive stone village, little bigger than a hamlet. He took his steely from his belt and wearily carved a vision rune into his left wrist. It lent him enough power to see that the village had a square and a small church. It would almost certainly have some sort of public house where he could rest for the night. Everything in his heart screamed to go on, to finish this. He could not be more than 20 miles from his goal, but to go on would be to kill his horse, and, he knew, to arrive at Cader Idris himself in no fit state to do battle with anyone. He turned back toward Balios, and with a measured application of coaxing and handfuls of oats, managed to get the horse to its feet. Gathered the reins in his hand, and squinting into the sunset, he began to lead Balios down the hill toward the village. The chair Tessa sat in had a high-carved wooden back, hammered through with massive nails, the dull ends of which poked into her back. In front of her was a wide desk, weighed down by books on one end. Before her on the desk was a clean tablet of paper, a jar of ink and a quill. Beside the paper sat John Shade's pocket watch. On either side of her stood two massive automatons. Little effort had been expended to make them resemble humans. Each was nearly triangular, with thick arms protruding from either side of their bodies, each arm ending in a razor-sharp blade. They were frightening enough, but Tessa could not help but feel that if Will were there, he would have commented that they looked like turnips, and perhaps made up a song about it.
"Take up the watch," said Mortmain, "and change."
He sat across from her in a chair much like hers, with the same high curving back. They were in another cave room, which he had been led to by automatons. The only light in the room came from an enormous fireplace, large enough to roast an entire cow in. Mortmain's face was cast into shadows, his fingers steeple below his chin. Tessa lifted the watch. It felt heavy and cool in her hands. She closed her eyes. She had only Mortmain's word that he had sent the Yin Fen, and yet she believed him. He had no reason not to do it after all. What difference did it make to him whether Jem Carstairs lived a little longer? It had only been a bargaining tool to get her into his hands, and here she was, Yin Fen or not. She heard Mortmain's breath hiss out between his teeth, and she tightened her fingers' grip on the watch. It seemed to throb suddenly in her grasp, the way the clockwork angel sometimes did, as if it had its own life within it. She felt her hand jerk, and then suddenly the change was on her. Without her having to will it or reach for it, as she usually did, she gave a little gasp as she felt the change take her like a harsh wind, pushing her down and under. John's shade was suddenly all around her, his presence enveloping hers. Pain drove up her arm, and she let go of the watch. It thumped to the desk, but the change was unstoppable. Her shoulders broadened under the dressing gown, her fingers turned green, the colour spreading up her body like verdigris over copper. Her head jerked upright. She felt heavy, as if an enormous weight were pressing on her. Looking down, she saw that she had a man's heavy arms, the skin a dark, textured green, the hands large and curved. A feeling of panic rose in her, but it was tiny, a small spark within an immense gulf of darkness. She had never been so lost inside a change before. Mortmain had sat upright. He was staring at her fixedly, his firm lips compressed, his eyes shining with a hard, dark light.
"Father," he said.
Tessa did not answer, could not answer. The voice that rose within her was not hers. It was Shade's.
"My clockwork prince," Shade said, The light in Mortmain's eyes grew. He leaned forward, pushing the papers eagerly across the table toward